Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest edition of Life on Planet Porky. Where is Planet Porky? Well, it's up there. It's across the universe, as John and might have said, and the full-time residents are myself. Excuse me, Michael Porky Parry. And, of course, the one and only incredible rock chick writer, Leslie Ann Jones. Leslie Ann, how is the planet treating you this fine day?
Well, not bad, Michael, thank you. We're getting through it, aren't we?
Yes.
I think making the best of our resources.
Indeed.
In these locked down times and keeping a smile on our faces and bringing the news from Planet Porky to the world.
Indeed we are. And talking about Planet Porky, of course, which is far, far away, a lot of people who are far, far away are going to be coming back into our country this week and then finally they've got to self-isolate for 14 days. I've put out a video protest about that. I don't know if you've seen it, but I'm absolutely livid that the airline industry is going to be further hampered from flourishing by what I regard as a really ridiculous imposition of the freedom of people, which, if it was going to be introduced, should have been introduced 3 months ago.
You're absolutely right. But I heard that British Airways, Ryanair and EasyJet are now suing the government over this.
Yeah, well, governments always try and find reasons for inquiries and that kind of stuff, usually to close down the issue at hand. Oh, I can't talk about that. There's an inquiry going on. They should do this in reverse now. They should cave in on this one because they know it's rubbish and say, look, due to a series of legal actions being mounted against us, we've had to postpone the imposition of this. But who am I to talk about politicians? Politicians are boring, and we try to stay away from politicians on Planet Porky, Leslie Ann, so that we can tell the audience about marvellous, glamorous, exciting tales like the time you met Muhammad Ali's daughter and your dad was involved in something to do with the boxing of the Muhammad Ali family.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, it was a really sweet thing, actually. A girl called Claire Lewins directed a film called I Am Ali, and it was based on some audio recordings that Muhammad Ali made himself during the 1970s. It also featured interviews with friends, family, notable people associated with professional boxing, of which my father was one. He and Ali were friends over many years.
You told me.
My father, dad covered lots of his fights.
Yeah.
He was at the Thriller in Manila, the Rumble in the Jungle.
Yeah.
He went to the training camp in Philadelphia, which very few journalists got to visit.
Yes.
And because of that, they invited my father to be in this film. And he talked about his experiences with Ali.
Yeah.
So we went to the premiere in London, which was in 2014.
Yeah.
And it was a great privilege to meet Ali's daughter, Mariam, there.
Right.
And it really touched me because my father had never met her before. And she came over and she said, "Sir, may I introduce myself? It is such a privilege to meet you." And he, of course, was feeling the same.
Yeah.
And so he said what he always said. He always addressed ladies as lovely. That was his name. He'd say,
"As what?
How are you, lovely?
Oh,
how are you doing, lovely?"
Right.
And so she called him sir. Mm. He addressed her back as lovely. And she started to cry. And it was the most moving moment. And I've got a picture of that, actually, which you may have seen on Twitter go past these last few days.
Yes.
He was a complicated man, wasn't he, Muhammad Ali? But he stood up for what he believed.
Oh, indeed.
Right.
Oh, he's so brave. I mean, stood up against
the draft, didn't he?
Yeah. Stood up against the Vietnam War, said those Viet Cong never did me no harm, and put at an end for 3 years the greatest boxing career in history. A very, very brave man. I've read all the books on Muhammad Ali, and there's nothing about him that I do not like. Whereas with Mike Tyson, I have a huge admiration for him as the youngest ever heavyweight boxing champion. But there's plenty about Mike Tyson I do not like. And you can't really compare the two outside of the ring.
Well, you wouldn't go to a hotel room with him, would you?
Well, no, you wouldn't. No, I totally agree. I mean, I thought he was treated very harshly in the criminal justice system in America because, you know, his behavioural pattern had been like that for years. But, you know, you can't excuse the sort of things he did, and so shouldn't you. Now, I was going to tell you...
You can't excuse his rape.
No, of course you can't.
But are you making a sensible decision as a woman by going to a hotel bedroom with somebody like that and then saying no at the last minute?
Oh, I totally agree. I mean, the stories about Mike Tyson are legendary. Driving down the strip in Las Vegas and his mate was driving. He was in the back seat with a girl. And when he and the girl had finished what they were doing, Mike Tyson said, come on, you have a go, clambered over into the front seat, took over the steering wheel, and then let his mate have a bit of fun with the lady in the back. I mean, the stories just go on and on and on. And
that's appalling. Horrible.
Sorry?
That's just appalling. Yeah, horrible.
Exactly. And that's the sort of thing that's associated with Mike Tyson. However, the most frightening individual human being I think a lot of people have ever seen, particularly those who had to get through those ropes and stand in a boxing ring with him. But that's another story. Now, I was going to tell you about my Duran story, because I saw a documentary on these guys over last weekend. And what struck me was how absolutely intelligent they were. The two that were talking mostly were Nick Rhodes and Roger Taylor, right? And they're in their 50s now. In fact, one of them's got a birthday this week. Can't remember which one. And I know that, I mean, loads of rock stars are very bright. You know, Brian May, obviously, and a lot of them came out of universities and colleges and all that kind of stuff. But these two guys were so measured about the rock industry. And did you ever meet any of them?
Oh, yeah. I did a lot of stuff with Duran way back when. In fact, I went through a spell of hanging around in Annabelle's and Tramp.
Really?
With John Taylor, who was a right scallywag, got to say.
Yeah.
Got me thrown out of a couple of clubs. He lived at large. You know, they were young. They were successful.
Yeah.
They went for it. And John took some calming down. I think they've all sort of come back down to earth now. But Nick Rhodes, of all of them, had a plan.
Right.
You know, he had an idea in his head from the beginning of how he wanted this band to form itself and what kind of music he wanted them to make. And of course, they didn't have Simon Le Bon on board at that point. They were all from Birmingham.
Yeah.
Simon Le Bon came from Pinner, and they were auditioning for a lead singer.
Pinner in Middlesex, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think they were, as a band, living proof of the old maxim that nothing exceeds like excess.
I totally agree. I mean, they showed the the Rio video, and it only dawned on me one of the reasons why they had such appeal was on that Rio video on that boat. They're all wearing very expensive coloured suits. You know,
Anthony Price suits, by the way.
Cost
about £2,000 each back then in the 80s.
Is that right?
Anthony Price, do you remember him? He styled Brian Ferry and various
people
who were big.
So who was the power in the group then who gave them that image? You know, like the Beatles image was forged by that lady who died a couple of weeks ago. Who forged Duran Duran's image?
So that was Astrid Kirshner. She did sadly die, bless her heart. But within the band, Duran Duran, this was Nick Rhodes. You know, he had the vision.
Oh, I
see. The
smile. Yeah. I didn't think the music was terribly great, to be honest. I mean, I like some of the records. The record I really like of theirs is The Reflex, because it's such an unusual record, you know. The Reflex.
I knew you were going to sing that.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because I recently co-wrote a memoir of a well-known music industry executive, David Ambrose.
Yes.
It's called How to Be a Rockstar. David Ambrose signed Duran Duran to EMI when he was head of plugging, basically. Mm. Head of A&R, they called it in those days. And he signed them to the record company and made stars of them.
Yeah.
And the stories were absolutely unbelievable. I mean, just his book should do really well, I think, because he really has lifted the lid.
Yeah.
But the tales of excess. And I had cause to re-listen to all of their music while I was writing this.
Oh, yes.
And most of it really didn't move me. I think at the time, back in the 80s, I thought they were fantastic, but I was young in those days.
Yeah.
And listening to it now...
You're still young, Leslie Ann.
Well, you know, youngish.
Early middle age.
Yeah, you know, but the music hasn't stood the test of time for me. Sorry.
I agree, but they came out of it largely untouched, in my view. You know, like for instance, Simon Le Bon is still married to the beautiful model, and they all seem to have escaped, you know, the worst perils of drug and all that. But anyway, just to move on, I used to live in the Midlands. I worked at the Birmingham Mail, and I worked in the Redditch district office. Redditch is a nice little town on the Warwickshire-Worcestershire border. It's about half an hour's drive from Birmingham at 6 o'clock in the morning. When I got transferred into Birmingham because my genius was recognised and they wanted me to work on the news desk in Birmingham.
And quite on, right.
Yes, exactly. And on the way in, I used to pick up one of the other news editors who did one of the other districts, like the Black Country or something. And he lived in a village, believe it or not, called Hollywood. And Hollywood's a little village halfway between Birmingham and Redditch, where I was driving in from. So you come off the dual carriageway and you go down this little lane, and there's Hollywood. There's only about, 30 houses in this street. And I pick up one morning, and his name's Fred Bromwich. I remember that because Bromwich, of course, is a Midlands location as well, West Bromwich. And I said, how are you, Fred? He said, oh, I'm really fed up. And what had happened was, two doors away, somebody had been playing the drums and a guitar all night long, and he'd been round twice and asked them to shut up. And, didn't they know this is a pleasant neighbourhood and all that? And it was Nick Rhodes and Roger Taylor. There was a Roger Taylor as well as a John Taylor, wasn't there?
There were three Taylors in the band.
There was
a Roger Taylor, a John Taylor, and an Andy Taylor. and they weren't brothers, which was very confusing for everyone.
I bet it was. Anyway, it's one of the Taylors anyway, Nick Rhodes, bashing drums. And nobody had ever heard of Duran Duran. And then about a year later, we all got invited to this launch party at the Rum Runner, which was a very sort of popular night spot in Birmingham. And when we went there, we realised these two kids that Fred had been talking about were actually the members of the band. So my claim to fame is I was at the birth of Duran Duran and saw it all the way through.
Well, you have greater claims to fame than that, darling.
Well, I probably do, but nevertheless, it's nice, isn't it, to have such a wide interest of things in life. Now, stupid question, Leslie Ann, because I'm almost certain the answer will be yes, but have you ever been to Monaco?
Oh, yeah.
Exactly. As
various times. I spent my first wedding anniversary there, actually.
Really?
And yeah, sort of knew by the end of the 3-day trip. We dropped in by helicopter. It was all very posh.
Oh, from Nice?
And I kind of knew by the end of the 3 days that, we were doomed.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's the kind of place that has that effect on you. It's a place of extremes, isn't it?
1 year into your marriage and you knew it was doomed. That's a bit sad.
Yeah, I did. But I was in denial.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, anyway, the reason I ask is because at the moment there's a great TV series running called Monaco, okay? And it's a fly on the wall thing, access to old Prince Albert and all that kind of stuff. But basically, just illustrating the enormously lavish lifestyle that people in Monaco lead. There's only 9,000 residents, right? Just reading from my notes here of the programme. It's one person who was there, who was interviewed on this show, right, said, she said, the beauty with Monaco is that I can walk down the street with a £1 million diamond necklace on and not have a single fear that anybody's going to steal it, because actually it's very small fry in Monaco. 9,000.
Well, there's an invitation to all the burglars in the world.
Yeah.
The muggers.
Yeah.
Here comes the woman with the £1 million necklace on.
Yes. Yeah, but she said that the £1 million necklace ain't that much in Monaco, and there's loads of them. People walking around in them all the time. You can only live there at the behest of Prince Albert. You have to wait years to become a resident. Only 9,000 residents. The rest are all sort of people who live there in rented or bought property. You've got to be able to put an immediate £500,000 down just to get into Monaco to rent anything. And when you're there, it's tax-free, the whole thing. And they raise their money on 20% VAT on all goods. And then the tourist trade, because, some of these places are like £13,000 a night, to lease an apartment.
Yeah, it's a rich place, but I'm not sure that's entirely true, because we had friends living down there.
Yep.
Hugh and Tammy from Australia. They were living in Monaco for about 5 years.
Yes.
And I can tell you for a fact they weren't that rich.
Yeah.
So, I think these things are exaggerated when they make these kind of TV shows, don't you?
Well, it might be, because I'll tell you a story. Mr. Brazil and I did the helicopter trip from Nice to Monaco once, right? And the reason we were going there was because, believe it or not, Chelsea were playing Monaco in the semi-final of the Champions League. And it's the weirdest football stadium in the world. It's on top of a car park because, Monaco's space is very, very tight, obviously. And And we stayed, I don't know, a hotel or something like that. But another reason we were there was because Ken Bates, who was then chairman of Chelsea and owner, I think, chairman and owner. Yeah, I think maybe he wasn't. Maybe Mr. Abramovich had just taken over and bought it from him. But Ken Bates and his lifelong partner, lovely Susanna, were living there. And we got invited round to Ken's for dinner. But on the day of the match, right, and funnily enough, I've been doing a bit of decluttering whilst we've all been in lockdown, and I found the receipt just the other day going through some papers. We had lunch at the Café de Paris on the square, OK, which I'm sure you'll know very well. It's one of the world's most famous casinos, and we had it outside on a table, and all these people turned up claiming to be friends of Alan Brazil. Well, they were friends of Alan Brazil, but I don't know how long they'd been friends. And they were very wealthy men. Some of them lived in Monaco and the others had flown over in a private jet because they were Chelsea fans, right? We had this lunch and at the end of it, they all just got up and said, thanks very much. And I said, Al, I said, who's paying for this lunch? He said, you are. I said, what? Because I was then the programme director of Talk Sport. And he said, yeah, I told the boys to come over and it would all be on Talk Sport. The bill was over 3,000 quid.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, but that's...
And what did the powers that be at TalkSport say about it?
Well, what I had to do was, even though I was the programme director, I wasn't above the rule of law. And when I got back, I had to tell the finance director that that bill was for the hire of a studio inside Café de Paris for 3 days because we couldn't find anywhere else and very expensive because of the demands on the place because Chelsea were there and somehow got away with it. But
creative thinking, huh?
Well, that's all I could do. But it was. I mean, the cost of everything was ludicrous. A bottle of wine at the table was £200. So I'm amazed that we got away with 3,000 quid. You know what I mean? But yeah. Anyway, there we are.
Did you ever go to the Grand Prix there?
Well, you see, funny you should say that because the week we went there for the football match, the Grand Prix was the following Sunday. And I had to get back because I had an important job. I was the programme director. Al asked for a couple of days off to stay to go to the Grand Prix. And, of course, they'd closed all the roads by then and it was very difficult to get around, you know what I mean, because the surface had to be swept and polished for the Grand Prix. But Al got one of the guys who came to lunch, the bill I paid for. One of them had a yacht in the harbour, invited Al on board, and Al watched the Grand Prix from one of the greatest vantage points on one of the bends on the circuit, actually goes round the harbour, and you can see all the yachts bobbing around right adjacent to the track, and that's where Al watched the Grand Prix. So it is a wonderful and lavish life, I have to say.
So that lunch was worthwhile after all, and Mr. Brazil owes you.
Yeah, well, it was worthwhile for him. It wasn't worthwhile for me. I was on the plane back to London, but there we are. Now, listen, one landmark we've mentioned but has actually now come and passed us is Tom Jones at 80.
I know. Unbelievable, isn't it?
Absolutely unbelievable. And I think I sent you a little note, didn't I? A little joke in it saying that, you know, even now when he goes on stage, he claims women are still throwing their underwear at him. Something which, of course, you managed to resist when you came to watch me on stage in London.
No, I always keep my knickers on. It's, yes, it's a rule of mine.
Yes, this is a family show, Leslie Ann, please.
You know, I read quite a lot of pieces about Tom Jones over the last few days. And yeah, it left me feeling very sad. You know, he was married to his wife, Linda, for centuries.
I think it was 56 years or something.
They were married at 16.
That's
they
right.
were both 16 years old. And
that's right.
So when he was 24, he had a 7-year-old son.
Yes.
But his wife never took part in his life. They did move to Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
But she never went on the road with him. She just sat in the house and watched television. And he always said she was the love of his life.
Yes.
And he was devastated when she died.
Yes.
But he had hundreds of affairs. Well, how can you call them affairs, really? Because, you know, it's just wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, isn't it, really?
Well, he was so popular with some of them.
He had one sort of quite extended affair with one of the Miss World.
Marjorie Wallace, I think.
Marjorie Wallace. And she was stripped of her crown because of it.
Yes.
Because it was considered so disgraceful that she had an affair with a married man.
Yeah.
But, you know, did he really love his wife, Linda, if he was putting it around out there?
Well,
because to a woman, that is a gigantic insult.
Yes.
If your husband is out there shagging.
Yes.
I wouldn't have put up with it.
Well, you see, it's quite amazing that, because as you quite rightly say, the Marjorie Wallace affair, I'm I'm sure that was a publicity stunt for both of them. It backfired on Marjorie Wallace, but it gave Tom a lot of footage around the world. And there were pictures of them posing on beaches in the Bahamas and all sorts of things. And I totally agree with you, what you say about, you know, could he really love his wife? But I do know, I have a friend from Fleet Street days, right, who I still occasionally hear about. We're not in touch anymore. But he was a serial shagger, this guy, in Fleet Street. You know what I mean? Anything, get his hands on, all that kind of
which
stuff.
Which particular one are we talking? Because I can think of about five off the top of my head.
Well, exactly. But what makes this one different is this guy actually did love his wife a lot. I mean, and we used to go to, not used to go to functions, but there'd be a Christmas function or something like that. And she'd be standing next to him, all doughy-eyed, you know, we're so in love and all that kind of stuff. And if she didn't know what was going on, then she must have been really thick. So I had to conclude that she did know what was going on, but just chose to turn a blind eye because she wasn't going to let their unison break up over the sexual proclivities of her husband.
Well, I think we live in a different time, don't we now? And I think the vast majority of wives would not accept this behaviour.
Yes. Well, I can't quite explain it because, of course, I've never been married, so I don't know about the bonds of, you know, marital ties and all that kind of stuff.
You had a lot of married girlfriends.
Well, I did, yes, I agree. But, I mean, then I was seeing it from the other side of the, you know, of the coin, I suppose. But
so how did they feel about, you know, cheating on their husbands?
I never asked them. I mean, some of them were just in for an exciting life. When you have a career in Fleet Street, as you know better than anybody, Leslie Ann, it is quite glamorous and quite exciting. One minute you're there standing at the bar, the next minute you've taken a phone call, you're on your way to Heathrow and you're off somewhere, or you're dashing off because in your case Boy George has just been arrested or something like that, and you're off up to Highgate and that kind of stuff. You know what I mean? It's a different sort of life, and people get attracted to it. I'm sure you've met men who've been fascinated by your career and the people you've met, and, you know, your close friendship with David Bowie. And I've met women who've been fascinated by it, not for the amount of famous people I've met, but for the places I've gone. You know, when you chat up a lady and tell her that last week you were in Libya and the US Air Force bombed you and you crawled out of the wreckage and all that kind of stuff, it tends to chime with them.
Yeah, and I guess going back to Tom Jones, you know, he's 80 now. How much sex is he really getting? You know, he's all a bit past it now, and he's got lots of time now to regret how he treated his poor wife.
You may well be right. Okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky. This is myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, I am today with Leslie Ann Jones, as ever. And talking about our working relationship, working partnership, Leslie, and I have to say, we've been receiving some very nice missives, some very nice messages and emails and that sort of thing lately about the output that we provide for Life on Planet Porky. And do you have a few in front of you that you'd like to tell us about?
Yeah, you know, sift through the postbag. It was heaving this week, gotta say.
Yes.
Thank you, everyone, for writing in. Got a chap called Dean Clements.
Oh, yes.
He's the security officer. He said, had I ever had an interaction with Pink Floyd? He was a big fan.
Right.
Yes, we went to the same college. I think we discussed that a couple
Regent
of podcasts
Street.
Ago, didn't we? Yeah. And I've seen Nick Mason, the drummer, at quite a lot of events over the years.
Yeah, I've seen Nick, by the way. I did one of those, you know, shares days where they give all the profits to charity, raise 3 million quid or something. And Nick was at that one talking about racing cars.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, he's big into cars. He's got a couple of big collections housed away in London. And then Don wrote to say that the 1967 Wimbledon tennis tournament was the very first thing ever covered on BBC Two in colour.
Oh.
And he asks, did I ever do the London Bridges charity walk? I did, in fact. I did that walk twice.
Yeah.
And I think it was about 26 miles long. We crossed all the bridges of London, took all day.
Right.
So maybe he and I met on that. I'd be very interested to know.
Oh, that's interesting.
And then we've got Dale Haynes wrote in to say how much he's enjoying the show. And Jonathan Jordan loved the Word in Your Attic podcast that I did with David Hepworth and Mark Ellen.
Oh, lovely.
Thank you very much for listening in on that.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, that's great. Well, folks, keep it coming. Those emails they arrive in one or two ways. You either send them to myself or Leslie Ann, or probably more appropriately to planetporkypod@gmail.com. We will try and answer all the ones we get. And thank you very much indeed for keeping in touch. I'm Mike Parry8 on Twitter, and Leslie Ann, you are?
At LAJ Writer.
Indeed you are, yeah. Right, now, in the first part of today's podcast, we ended it by talking about women who suffer the ignominy of their husbands running around, you know, shagging everything they can get their hands on. And one woman who can certainly chime with that sort of experience is again subject of a TV series this week, and that is Hillary Clinton. Now, she might be one of the famous people that we talk about, Leslie Ann, that I might know a bit more about than you do. Did your paths ever cross?
Not ever personally, but no. I know yours did.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, I used to see her in Washington at functions and that kind of stuff. I got invited to the inauguration ball in Washington when Bill Clinton was finally inaugurated, because, as you well know, having been to America so many times, the election takes place in November. That's the one that Donald Trump is seems to be preparing for already this coming November. And then there's a period of sort of calm until January, and the inauguration takes place in January. I've been to three or four inaugurations in January, in Washington, D.C. in January. It is always freezing. It is always about minus 10. All the candidates and all the crowd are always dressed in huge Crombie overcoats with scarves because it's so freezing cold. And in the evening, they have balls all around Washington. There's not just one inauguration ball, there's about 30. And the president tries to do about, you know, half of them and that kind of stuff. For some unknown reason, I got to know Bill Clinton's mother, because I used to go down. I thought Bill Clinton was going to win 6 months ahead of the election, because I'd been down to Little Rock and weighed up what it was all about. And during the course of that, Little Rock in Arkansas, the poorest state in the Union, met his mother. And lo and behold, an invitation suddenly arrived week before the the inauguration, saying, come to my ball. So I went there.
Did she have her eye on you then, Clinton's mum? Did she kind of have the hots for you?
No, she was too old even for me, to be honest. And she just liked my Englishness, you know what I mean? And remember that Bill was a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford University. So she'd been over and visited a few times and fallen in love with England. And just liked the fact that a guy from an English newspaper had bothered to go down there to see them, you know, because everybody else had written Bill Clinton off. But Hillary is such an interesting woman. We've talked about her before, but I mean, she knew what was going on with Bill Clinton from day one, from the time they met at Yale University. And yet, to her, it was always a business plan, and the ultimate business plan. And I told people this, by the way, just after Clinton got elected the first time. I said, the next president of the United States of America is going to be Hillary Clinton. Bill will do two terms, and then she'll take over. Because she was running a lot of it during his second term. She was, you know, dictating policy. She was an incredibly driven woman who didn't care about Bill's dillying and dallyings unless they became public.
Well, she's Lady Macbeth all over again, isn't she? But
yeah.
I think there's a sense of untrustworthiness about Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
People who have never met her in their lives hate her intensely.
Yeah, they do.
They absolutely despise her.
Yes.
And I don't think it's this sort of vast right-wing conspiracy that she used to talk about. You know, people have been saying for years that she's a closet lesbian, faking her 40-odd year marriage and so on.
Yeah.
And that she's a member of the Illuminati, you know, this secret society that's supposed to run the world and so on. But the hostility towards her does actually span decades. And it's quite hard to understand.
Yeah. I totally agree with that. You know, in America, people either really love her. I mean, she's well loved on the East Coast because the Eastern Seaboard is very liberal, as you know. You know, all the way down from sort of Massachusetts to New York and Connecticut, New York, down there, and Washington, very sort of left wing. So they took to her right away. But in other parts of the Union, I totally agree. And she killed off her own presidential hopes by insulting the Trump voters. Trump was in a bit of a slump until she called them, you know, terrible names. And how could such people ever follow such a terrible man and all this kind of stuff. And that the polls changed overnight and she was out. But you're absolutely right. Even Democrats have to bite their lip very hard to vote for Hillary Clinton. But anyway, the TV show of her is very, very interesting. And some people still haven't written her off as, you know, maybe again one day making a bid for the presidency.
She's 72 now. I'm not sure. I mean, the world feels very safe in the company of old men, don't we?
Well,
but I think we're still not so sure about old women. And 72 for a woman is much older than 72 for a man.
Well, yes, I agree with all of that, except that the current Speaker of the House, old Nancy What's-Her-Name, she's nearer 80, you know. She's about 79. And
yeah, but you don't have to do much being a Speaker of the House, do you? Just sit there, really, and go, order!
Well, no,
order!
But you're a big power broker, believe me, in America when you're the Speaker. And the other thing is, remember that if Joe Biden gets in this year, he will be the oldest ever president, even older than Ronald Reagan. So I'm just assuming from that that we're stretching out another decade of active life in people about every 30 years. You see what I mean?
For men. I definitely think that's the case for men.
Yeah.
But do you remember her comment? She was quite scathing, wasn't she, Hillary? When she said, I'm not sitting here being some little woman standing by your man like
that's
Tommy
right.
Wynette.
She did.
And I thought, oh dear, big mistake.
Yep.
You know, it's she should bite her tongue a bit more than she does.
Well, right from the very start, you're absolutely right. Even before the election happened, she went on to a TV show and, you know, the two of them together, you know, sitting there holding hands and all that. And you're absolutely right. I don't sit at home and bake cakes. But told the nation, vote for Bill, because if you vote for Bill, you get two for one. She was actually making it public that she was going to have a great deal to do with things when she got in. She was the first lady to have her own offices in the East Wing, you know, which was taken on then by Michelle Obama. And I don't think the current first lady is that interested. But I mean, she was the most powerful.
I think the opposite.
Yeah.
She always looks, Melania, she always looks so bored and terrified with everything that's going on, doesn't she? And the heels get higher and higher and higher.
Yeah, I was going to say, she looks completely disinterested in everything that's going on around her, including what her husband's doing. You know, Bill is currently in charge of race riots across America and inflaming everybody with, you know, amazing outbursts of gibberish, really, some people would say. And she is, I agree, she's completely at ease with it, or completely bored. Now,
maybe she's drugged up to the eyeballs. I mean, she certainly looks that way. But
do you think
girl.
So? I think so,
yeah. She never smiles, and he's always whispering to her, smile, smile. And then this sort of, this little crack appears on her face that never reaches the eyes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, look, you may well be right. You know, you're able to read women's faces a lot better than me. Wish I had more experience in the ability to read women's faces.
Oh, I'll teach you. Let's have some sessions.
Definitely, yeah. It would have saved me a great deal of grief, I think, in the past. Now, just getting back to John Jones from now, I forgot to tell you the story that really tickled me last week, and that was that when he met Elvis Presley, somebody suggested they should all go out, to a very private, very exclusive restaurant somewhere, with a private room at the back and all that. And according to Tom Jones, Elvis said, I can't go out. I can't go out anywhere. No matter where I go, I get everybody's giving me attention. Everybody spots me. And Tom Jones says, well, look, Elvis, when I go out, I do it sort of in disguise. You know, I sort of put a hat on or something like that, put some glasses on, all that kind of stuff. He says, no, I can't do that. He said, why? He said, because if I'm not Elvis, I'm not Elvis. I've got to be Elvis. So Tom, you know, advised him, well, next time you go out and you want to go to a restaurant and be a little low-key, you take off this suit, because Elvis used to walk around in his stage suits all the time.
Oh, in the rhinestones.
The long sideburns and the glasses. And he never stopped being Elvis Presley and said he couldn't go out looking like anybody else.
Mm. Yeah, well, that was a mistake.
Well, it was a total mistake, but that's Elvis for you.
Let me ask you something about Tom Jones. Can you remember what his birth name was? Because it wasn't Jones.
Yeah, I think it was Smith.
Some is what I thought it was Woodward or something like that.
Yeah, Woodward. Question, it was. I think it was Woodward.
Question: who changes their name to Jones?
Yeah,
it's the second most common name. Yeah. Who would change their name to Jones?
Yeah,
and I've spent my whole life as a Jones. So
right, yeah,
I would change it
right.
to something else, but I wouldn't change it to the most common name in the valleys. Would you?
I totally agree. That's a puzzle to me as well. Why you change it to something that everybody knows? I mean, Elton John, very very different to Reg Dwight. And what was Cliff Richard's birth name? Harry Webb.
Oh, Harry Webb.
Yeah. But
and then you got Marty Wilder, who was Reg. I think he was a Reg Smith or something.
Yeah, something like that.
I can't remember what Billy Fury was, but changing your name back then was a big thing. You know, it was common among rock and pop stars to do that. But why would you change your name to Jones?
No,
I don't get it.
I totally agree. Now, talking about great women, as we have done all the way through this podcast. I read this amazing piece involving a young lady called Beyoncé, who I'm sure you know very well or know of very well. And what she's saying is, Beyoncé is saying Cleopatra was absolutely right. Treat them mean, keeps them keen. And she's talking about men. And she is referring to a report done by some guy from Israel, an Israeli university, which concludes, we found that when people feel greater certainty that a prospective romantic partner reciprocates their interest, they will put more effort into seeing that person again and even rate the possible date as more sexually attractive than they would if they were less certain about the prospective date's romantic intentions. And what that concludes in saying, that long-winded explanation, is that if you don't show a great deal of interest in a man, he will redouble his interest in you. Have you found that to be the case, Leslie Ann? Because that's what Beyoncé says.
Well, you know, she's right. It does seem to be the case that if you treat them mean, you keep them keen, and you have to be hard to get. I think it's just about wanting what we can't have.
Yeah,
we're more likely to pursue somebody who's aloof, aren't we? But the aloof one has to have a bit of interest in the first place. Mm. Otherwise, all that effort at aloofness is a complete waste of time.
Yeah.
I don't know why it should be the case, and it shouldn't be the case in the 21st century. Mm. Women should be able to pursue men just as men pursue women, but it's still considered not very ladylike.
Yeah. Well, loads of women have chased me in my life, and I bet. No, that's not an idle boast, but you've got to remember when I was in my sort of, well, between my mid-20s up to my sort of early 40s or something like that, I was what could be considered a high-powered single man. You know, I had executive roles in Fleet Street and then in radio. I'm not really a great-looking bloke, but I'm not a bad-looking bloke, if you see what I mean.
Don't do yourself down. I watched girls throw themselves at you.
Well, yes, I didn't want to say so, but, I mean, if that's the observation that you personally have, Leslie Ann, who am I to argue? But you know, women would seriously think, I can't understand how Mike Parry's still single. And that's because...
Your options open.
Well, I wasn't keeping my options open. I never panicked about getting married, and I know some blokes have got married in their early 20s, but of course it doesn't last because they panicked into marriage and all that kind of stuff. I just frankly put my career so far ahead of everything else, I didn't want anything to erupt it. Totally selfish, I totally agree, but that's the way I wanted to run my life. And then in the end, time ran out and I couldn't face the prospect of sharing my life with somebody else when I had it so well organised in my own image, you know. And again, that's very selfish, but that's just the way I was. But what I'm saying is that I was happy, as you've alluded to many times, to have flings with, you know, ladies, and some of them were single and some of them weren't. Some of them were a bit in between and all that kind of stuff. But the closer they wanted to get to me, the more the writing was on the wall that this relationship wasn't going to last. And the minute a woman said to me, and it happened a couple of times, they wanted to leave their husband and move in with me, that was it, I'm afraid.
Mm. So was there ever
That was a sigh of disapproval.
Well, no, I far be it from me to judge, but was there ever a woman who you desperately wanted that you would have given it all up for who didn't want you back?
No, because, and we have touched on this before, my first girlfriend, Trudy, I went out with for 5 years. And that should have developed. That should have just been, you know, the normal, you know, schoolboy, schoolgirl crush, and then teenage adolescence, and then early adulthood. And the whole thing should have been like that story from that bloke who tied his house to blooms and floated off. You know what I mean? What was that called? Remember? A Pixar film, yeah.
Up. It was called Up.
That's right, yeah. And they had this wonderful relationship, but they never had children. And then when she died, he floated off of this house. So it should have been a dream relationship. And it, when it ended at, when I was 21, because I wanted to move off of my career, that was the last prospect I ever had of going through a relationship to its finality, if you see what I mean.
So, but you're harking back to something that never actually existed. You know, it's a fantasy in your head.
Yeah.
It probably wouldn't have panned out like that, but it's very comfortable and comforting for you to remember it in those terms.
Yes.
So that you can justify never having got married to anybody else.
Yes. No, you could be right. But the problem I've always had, and I've explained this to two or three women to sort of ease the pain. Okay, so I was going out with one woman, and every time we met, we went to a 5-star hotel, and we would eat in the room. You know, a waiter would arrive with a trolley with champagne on it and food and all that kind of stuff, you know, and we'd stay well into the early hours of the next morning, and then she'd have to go home or something like that, right? Now, what I tried to explain a number of times was, this is because we have this sort of relationship. But if we got married, if you left your husband and moved in with me and we became a couple, we wouldn't go to any 5-star hotels and we wouldn't have any bottles of champagne. We would then enter into a normal working relationship where you have to work very, very hard at it just to keep it together. Do you see what I mean?
Oh, yeah. And that becomes boring very quickly, doesn't
yes,
it?
Yes.
Which is what many, many people are finding during lockdown, that you know, being with the same person around the clock, 24 hours a day, and not having the breaks of going to work and having your social life with your friends from work and other people, playing sport, doing all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
When you're locked down with that same person, that's make or break.
Yes. No, I totally agree with you. We spoke about Susie Quattro in the last podcast. Another individual woman singer who I've admired for years, A, because I like her songs, and B, I think she's tough and gritty, is Bonnie Tyler. And,
oh, I love Bonnie Tyler. Right, she's a fellow Welsh woman.
Exactly. 68 this week. Have you had dealings with her?
Lots of times, and she's a truly wonderful person.
Right.
She used to come to some of the award ceremonies that I've attended over the years.
Yes.
Well, people would say, oh, come on, Bonnie, get up, give us a song. And she always would. There was never any, so, oh, no, I couldn't possibly. I haven't got my band.
Yeah.
I haven't got my amp. I haven't got my own microphone.
Yeah.
She would always just get up and belt out a song.
That's fantastic.
And when, she told me once that when she was auditioning back in the day, back in the valleys, when she was, you know, 14 or something and trying to get a break, she would literally go into the phone box at the end of the road and ring up some agent and sing to them down the phone from the phone box. Which I thought was a wonderful story.
Fantastic, absolutely. I love I was lost in France.
Oh, yeah.
In the trees, the birds were singing. I think that's it's a great record. I can imagine waking up in a you know, a field full of dew in France, you know, in the summer, and birds singing in the trees and all that kind of stuff, and then drifting off down into the village to a little bar with a bottle of wine on it and all that kind of stuff, you know. So, yeah, I thought she was great.
Did you see that thing on the over on the weekend? Was Jane McDonald, the singer who used to be on the cruise ships?
Yes.
And she's on television quite a lot now. And she happened to sing that very song.
Really?
On her show on Saturday. I wasn't really watching it. I was cooking.
Yeah.
And, you know, flick through the channels, what's on. And she was on some river cruise. And up she popped singing that very song. And she didn't sing it too badly, but it made me think how great Bonnie's version of that song was.
Oh, it was. She had a unique voice, didn't she? She had the Rod Stewart version of a lady's voice.
Gravel in a biscuit tin.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, it was terrific. So there we are. Sadly, we've come to the end of another podcast, Leslie Ann. What are your plans for your immediate future now that the world is getting easier to move around? Are you going to be moving around?
I'm trying to take it easy, you know, being very careful. I'm fortunate to have three giant children in the house with me
right.
who run around and do the shopping and do the chores and so on.
Brilliant.
Leaving me free to get on with my work. So yeah. I'm kind of lashing the whip here a little bit.
That's good. Well done. I have to say that, you know, I've had to bone up on my technology since lockdown. And I have been busy most every day. I've got television this week. That takes 2 days because there's a day of preparation for it. And then you do it and all that kind of stuff. So I'm you know, looking forward to a busy week as well. So Leslie-Anne, thank you very much indeed. Can I just say a big thanks to all our listeners?
Yes, and keep the letters coming. Really enjoying reading them. And stay safe and stay well, everyone.
I endorse those words indeed. Stay safe, everybody. Back again with you very soon. I have a friend from Fleet Street days, right, who I still occasionally hear about. We're not in touch anymore. But he was a serial shagger, this guy, in Fleet Street. You know what I mean? Anything to get his hands on, all that kind of
which
stuff.
Which particular one are we talking? Because I can think of about five off the top of my head.
Well, exactly. But what makes this one different is this guy actually did love his wife a lot. I mean, and we used to go to, not used to go to functions, but there'd be a Christmas function or something like that. And she'd be standing next to him, all doughy-eyed, you know, we're so in love and all that kind of stuff. And if she didn't know what was going on, then she must have been really thick. So I had to conclude that she did know what was going on, but just chose to turn a blind eye because she wasn't going to let their unison break up over the sexual proclivities of her husband. We had this lunch, and at the end of it, they all just got up and said, thanks very much. And I said, Al, I said, who's paying for this lunch? He said, you are. I said, what? Because I was then the programme director of Talk Sport. And he said, yeah, I told the boys to come over and it would all be on Talk Sport. The bill was over 3,000 quid. I'm not really a great-looking bloke, but I'm not a bad-looking bloke, if you see what I mean.
Don't do yourself down. I watched girls throw themselves at you.
Well, yes, I didn't want to say so, but, I mean, if that's the observation that you personally have, Leslie-Anne, who am I to argue?